This is John Hockenberry. Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway, produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. We'd love for you to be a part of the conversation. Find and friend us at Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and there's more at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The grim rescue and recovery in the Philippines is our focus this hour. Perhaps the most brutal encounter between a densely urbanized human settlement and the natural forces of the atmosphere. Typhoon Haiyan, one of the most powerful storms ever recorded, blasted ashore over the weekend, producing thousands of dead, displacing as many as 500,000 people. The city of Tacloban seems to be at the center of the devastation, but there is destruction across a wide area of this nation of thousands and thousands of islands. Joining us now is Orla Fagan, Humanitarian Affairs Officer for the United Nations Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Orla, what can you say as we begin the week where things stand?
It looks like the government figures are telling us that there's 9.8 million people affected by this typhoon. And you're right, you know, they're telling us that there's 584,000 people displaced. This is a very, very, very conservative estimate. We still haven't reached many areas. We are doing our best. We're working 24/7. And as this week goes on, these numbers will probably go up and up and up.
And what would you say is the situation for the city of Tacloban?
The city of Tacloban seems to be wiped out. They can't get past. We don't even know what's going on outside the city because they can't get past it. The road between the airport and the town itself, when our team arrived down, they couldn't get down to that airport. For a 7-mile journey, it's taking 6 hours for a round trip. So you can imagine the difficulty in trying to get aid in and out of that town. They were using helicopters and they did get 6,000 food packs delivered on Saturday. But this is the kind of challenges they're facing the whole time in trying to get life-saving aid into the people, food, water, shelter.
And when we're talking about upwards of 10,000 islands in the Philippines, I imagine there's a good number of islands that are still completely isolated.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the island of Samar is not that isolated either in terms of it's a large island and the teams are really doing their best to try and get in there. Busuanga has opened up today and this flight's going in. A team arrived this afternoon. Apparently the town of Rojas, the city of Rojas, has been quite severely damaged as well.
Is there a specific sort of either humanitarian crisis that you expect in the next couple of days that would relate to water safety, that sort of thing? We understood the failure of nuclear power plants in Japan complicated the tsunami there. Are there red lights on the horizon that concern you as we go forward here?
Not in terms of nuclear plants, but certainly there's another typhoon or a cyclone, a tropical weather system moving in this way again. And it seems that it's heading towards us. It might hit tomorrow. I'm hoping and praying, as I'm sure that many people in the Philippines are, is that it'll stay at a one or drop lower and that it certainly won't increase. The problem at the moment is that the ocean water is warm, which starts bringing up the weather systems. I know more about weather systems now than I ever imagined I would know, but this is what's causing the problems, is these weather systems are emphasized or inflated by this warm water in the ocean.
Orla Fagan, the Humanitarian Affairs Officer at the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, attempting to deal with the aftermath of Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines. So, Orla, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Closer to home now, some voices trying to help the people of the Philippines from afar. First, Alex Montanses joining us from the Long Beach area in Southern California. Alex, how are you today?
I'm just fine, thank you.
Who are you trying to reach and who's in harm's way as far as you can tell right now?
Yeah, I'm trying to reach my cousins. They're my first cousins there in Tacloban, Leyte, in the Philippines. These were cousins who I grew up with. You know, when I would go back to the Philippines with my mom and dad to visit, you know, we kind of grew up together and they would come visit the States and sometimes I would come to the Philippines. And now we're all in our 20s and 30s and they have families and small children, but we haven't really heard from them since Friday when the storm hit.
And what are your limitations? I mean, obviously, communication is down. We've just been speaking to the United Nations, who has a very little idea of what's going on inside the city.
Yeah, I mean, the number one thing is there's no power, there's no internet, it's really hard for people to communicate. I've mostly been speaking to my parents, and they've been speaking to some of my other aunts and uncles here in the States. And so everybody's trying different ways to call or try to use the internet and, you know, trying to talk to different other relatives or family friends who may have communication through phone. And so, I mean, it's just incredibly difficult to talk to anybody near Leyte or Samar or any of the other places that were affected. So the number one thing is the communication. And number two, even my family was thinking of going on vacation this, you know, in the next couple of weeks for Christmas and everything. And I don't really know what'll be left when they go back.
Well, you'll have to take the advice of humanitarian workers who will either encourage or discourage people from coming to the most affected areas. And between now and then, every bell, every email sign on your computer, I suppose, is a sign of hope that maybe you've reached through.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the scariest thing was really the last time we did hear from them on Friday was that my uncle's house, this is my mother's eldest brother, was completely gone, completely blown away. And also, I have some godparents over there who were stranded on the roof for quite some time. So, you know, it's really reminiscent of, you know, like Hurricane Katrina and a lot of the other disasters where the most poor and the most marginalized are really the most affected by this storm.
Would your uncle and your cousins have taken precautions and gone to higher ground or had the option to, in advance of the storm, go somewhere where they might be protected?
I'm sure that a lot of them would have tried to take those precautions. You know, I feel like the storm went really quick, but then even more so, you know, the storm surge was also something that really was not really communicated well to them in terms of, you know, that kind of wave of water and sand coming from the beach. And Tacloban is right there along the beach. So when the reporters, or I don't know if it was the reporters, but when the emergency signal communication came out that there was a storm surge, it's not like a lot of people even knew what that word meant, you
Right,
know?
right, right. And 13 to possibly even 23 feet. Alex Montan says, good luck to you, sir.
Yes, thank you.
Alex Montan says his regional coordinator with the National Alliance for Filipino Concerns trying to get news about his family who live all in that area hit most severely by Haiyan. Alex is just one of many people trying to reach family or coordinate relief efforts by mobilizing the large Philippine American population in the U.S. The long history between the U.S. and the former Spanish colony will help efforts being made here to assist those affected by Typhoon Haiyan. And joining me now is Dr. Rommel Riviera. He's president of the Filipino American Association of Philadelphia. Hello, doctor.
Hi, John.
Remind us of the close relationship between the United States and the Philippines that goes back well over a century.
So from 1898 to 1946, the Philippines was a colony of the United States. And since then, the United States and the Philippines had very close ties. As you may remember, the biggest military bases of the United States were in the Philippines, Clark Air Force Base and Subic Bay, the naval base. But most importantly, the Philippines and the United States fought side by side in World War II. We need to remember that, especially today, Veterans Day, that hundreds and thousands of people died in the Bataan Death March during World War II, American soldiers as well as Filipino soldiers.
How are you trying to stay in touch with people, family members, connections in the Philippines, and how difficult has it been?
It's very difficult because communications is down, electricity is down, everything is down on that devastated area in central Philippines. So it's very difficult. So we're getting communication through the consulate general in New York, friends that may send us an email or cell a phone. So in general, it's very difficult to get information.
How vulnerable is the Philippines? I mean, this is one of the most densely populated places in the world, if you look just at Manila.
Well, the population of the Philippines is about 95 million. That area devastated is in the central Philippines, so it's not as dense as Manila or Luzon, the big island, but nonetheless, many people were affected there.
And can you tell us about Tacloban, the city that seems to have been at the center of the devastation?
Well, Tacloban is the capital city of Leyte, which is the province in central Philippines. The center of the typhoon struck that area and it's totally devastated.
And in that city, there's been a storm surge of 13 to 20 feet. It's hard to get a specific gauge. Is this a harbor city? Is this a city where most of the people live very, very near to the water? What shelter might there have been?
Well, it's unfortunate that this city, although it's beautiful, is surrounded by water. Three-fourths of it, I was told, is surrounded by water. So it's a coastline city. And so winds and water from the sea soared. The description is as high as trees, like coconut trees.
So, are you responsible for coordinating or beginning to coordinate the effort of getting humanitarian aid from families here in the United States to places in the Philippines that can distribute aid and assist with communications?
Yes, we have begun our efforts to coordinate aid to the Philippines. Had last weekend we have scheduled events already that we are using to fundraise, and part of these fundraising events, part of them will go to the Philippines. We are planning to do concerts and other things, and all these efforts we are going to divert funds through the National Federation of Filipino American Associations and the Philippine Disaster and Recovery Foundation will be the conduit of funds from here to the Philippines.
Dr. Rivera, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Dr. Rommel Rivera is president of the Filipino American Association of Philadelphia. If you have a story like Dr. Rivera's or Alex before him, please call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org to see how you can join the relief effort in the Philippines.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com.
As the youngest man ever elected president of the United States, JFK represented promise, idealism, and uncertainty. That was the outward JFK. What few people knew about him were his inner battles with chronic health problems that nearly killed him on a number of occasions, his toughening as a second son in the competitive Kennedy clan. John F. Kennedy came to the White House confident and tough, but unseasoned and inexperienced. The failed Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba showed that inexperience early on, but the nuclear confrontation between the U.S. and the Soviet Union showed the confident Kennedy, who led the U.S. into a standoff with the Russians and then led the world away from a nuclear holocaust.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
Because he was assassinated just a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, we're left with puzzle pieces that do not make a complete picture of a presidency. Glimpses of brilliance, a shining beacon of glamour and innocence, but with much of his program undone and mistakes about to be made and made. A puzzle.
We will never know whether he would have been a great president. I bet on him, but we didn't have that chance.
One of the voices from the PBS special American Experience, JFK, it airs tonight on PBS stations and was produced by our partner, WGBH. Historian and author Robert Caro is a contributor to that documentary. He's also the author of The Passage of Power, The Times of Lyndon Johnson. Caro says it is almost impossible to separate the qualities of Kennedy and his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, to calculate a legacy for either one of these towering figures. It is these strange opposites in personality and strength that came together in the moment Oswald's bullet took away JFK forever.
Jack Kennedy had this wonderful way of touching our idealism and the highest things in America. And he had made this wonderful speech introducing the Civil Rights Bill. But at the fact is, unpleasant as it is to look at it, that at the time of his assassination, that civil rights bill was going nowhere in Congress. Lyndon Johnson comes in and rescues it because he is a great lawmaker. Jack Kennedy had not really been all that involved in the work of the Senate.
And the work of the Congress, the workings of government itself. Jack Kennedy touched America, but he had yet to touch Washington.
That's a terrific way of putting it. A columnist wrote, Jack Kennedy's eloquence is designed to make men think. Lyndon Johnson's words are designed to make men act, you know, and that is a difference.
Perhaps the best evidence of the Kennedy presidential legacy is how he performed during the Cuban Missile Crisis, in the sense that all of his confidence and his intellectual power and his willingness to take risks, and he was the crazy risk taker of the family, came to the fore there. And it really showed him to be presidential in a way that almost no other event during the JFK tenure does. What do you make of the Cuban Missile Crisis?
I think it shows this is the greatness of Jack Kennedy. You know, when you listen to the tapes of the Cuban Missile Crisis, there are moments. The Russians on Cuba have shot down another United States spy plane. All around that table, we said if they did this, we'd attack. We're going to attack now. We must attack tomorrow. Everyone is pushing, everyone, the majority are pushing for an invasion or an all-out bombing attack on Cuba. You know what Jack Kennedy says? Gentlemen, it's time to take a break for dinner. Let's come back and discuss this later. When he establishes this quarantine line and the Russian ships are headed towards it, and he said if one of the Russian ships cross it, we're going to stop and board it. This is the moment when wars start. Time and again, during these 13 days of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy draws them back, in effect saying, let's not stop this ship. We'll stop the next ship. Let's give peace one more day. Maybe I can negotiate with Khrushchev. Maybe we can work it out. And finally, he does. And you really say, you know, we were on the verge of nuclear war. We were so close then. Everything else in Kennedy's presidency, in my view, pales before what he did in that most crucial of moments when mankind was really facing the possibility of nuclear war.
In Kennedy's life on his way to the White House, the question was, is he tough enough? Johnson didn't believe he was tough enough. Historians have pointed out that nobody in the Cuban Missile Crisis team was without questions about whether Kennedy was tough enough. You've made a career as a historian of getting into the heads of these leaders and these mythological figures. Do you think Kennedy believed he was tough enough during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
You know, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, he's just finished reading Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August.
Mm. We're one about World War One.
About how World War One started. He says, you know, that was the Guns of August. If I make a mistake here, they're going to be writing a book about this and they're going to call it The Missiles of October. Kennedy is really tough.
So thinking back 50 years, do we yearn for Kennedy's capacity to make a decision and Johnson's capacity to act and deliver qualities we don't find today?
If I can put it in terms of my book, I call it the passage of power. It's a passage of power from one president with certain qualities to another president with very opposite qualities. But if you were to put those qualities together, Kennedy's eloquence and his ability to touch the highest idealism of America, and Johnson's fantastic ability to get these bills, I mean, you listen to Johnson cajoling, bullying, flattering, listening to congressmen, what do they really want? What are they really afraid of? You know, what do I have to do to get their votes? You say, those are two people with opposite qualities, but really striking qualities.
Robert Caro, thanks so much.
Always great to be here, John.
Robert Caro is the author of The Passage of Power and Dallas, November 22nd, 1963. He's also featured in WGBH's American Experience, JFK.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
On this Veterans Day, we note that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are winding down, and we're thankful for that. The battle's over. The fate of those nations now more in their hands than in the hands of U.S. men and women in uniform. But the soldiers who fought so long and hard in Iraq and Afghanistan are coming home. Veteran Robert Mitchell has already been back for a while. He has some advice. It is hard to hear this, and even harder to do, says Robert. But you're going to have to leave your combat experience where you had it, because every combat vet that I know left a lot of themselves there and didn't bring enough of themselves home.
James Smith, I am a retired hospital corpsman. Any program that supports veterans, get yourself involved, either by helping others or looking for help yourself. Those are the best ways to get yourself back into civilian world.
Getting back into the civilian world, it's a challenge. Bringing enough of yourself home from the battle zone, it's a challenge. And we're getting advice from veterans for veterans. For the rest of this hour, the practical advice from vet to vet. We'll also have some deeper wisdom from veterans as a jazz musician, Vijay Iyer, takes the voices of veterans speaking of their dreams in a remarkable musical project. We got on the line to hear the practical advice from two recent vets. Jason Wazelski, who's a former Army medic who served in Afghanistan in 2012. We also spoke with David Retzky, former UAV pilot who served in Iraq from 2004 to 2005. They see a lot of smiles out there in the communities that are greeting them now as civilians, but not a lot of jobs right away.
It's a bit of a mixed bag right now, John. Right now, we are very popular as veterans. They believe we are very liked, and everyone respects veterans nowadays, especially compared to the Vietnam era. But at the same time, that respect may not translate into something really important as getting a job. So you may be highly respected, and everyone tells you, especially in the military, that you're going to be sought after. But when you look at the realistic numbers, vets, especially 25 to 29, have a high rate of unemployment, almost 15%. And in reality, it's because a lot of what you learn in the military, either you don't know how to translate it well, or it doesn't translate into an actual civilian job.
Oh, absolutely. There's one thing that I think the VA and other groups have done a good job recently is doing, and that's pushing that issue, like David said, about the unemployment rate for vets. And I think, like, I saw a commercial the other day, Walmart is hiring veterans within a year of their service being up. You know, you go in and apply and they give you a job kind of thing. I don't know how permanent that is how long they're going to do it, but that's just an example of other agencies trying to help out vets and whatnot.
Finding help, getting advice. We'll hear more from Jason and David later on in this hour. From Nogales, Arizona, we got this advice. Make peace with your sins, knowing that the alternative was worse. It's what keeps me sane. That veteran from Nogales, Arizona. Waynesville, North Carolina. By far the most important priority is to ensure you get an education that can combine your military skills with the needs of a civilian career. And here's a good one. Veterans are no longer a silent group. Veterans are also no longer only men. We are organized, have built a solid community that will be present for generations to come. Find this community. Talk to them. Work with them. Your experiences in combat are an evolution. It changes you. That is a good thing. Our nation must always possess those who have seen evil. Give yourself time to readjust. It usually takes a year to even start to feel normal. That's from Shelley Good Burgoyne.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been long, but disabilities incurred during combat last a lifetime. And a lifetime is what it feels like to be part of the backlog of veterans awaiting disability compensation from the Veterans Administration.
I'm not the only one in this backlog, and that's my main concern, is that I've seen a lot of guys, good guys, get out the military, get stuck in this backlog, and most of them wind up getting in trouble. Most of them don't get the compensation they need. You know, that little buffer would help them identify with the problem, get the treatment, and continue on with their life, but unfortunately, a lot of them don't.
That's Iraq War veteran Jason Ayala waiting 2 years for his claim, still not acted on by the VA. Marine Edwin Del Rio got to a very bad place before his claim was finally approved.
First time I was living off of top ramen noodles for several weeks, and I'd take out payday loans because I didn't have enough money to get myself through the month.
I think we can say that they've gone from an F to a B, and that's huge progress.
These voices come to us from our friends at the Center for Investigative Reporting, and that's Congresswoman Jackie Speier, who has been one of the leading lawmakers trying to get the VA to respond to waiting veterans. Since this spring, there's been a remarkable success. The VA has improved despite the sequester and the shutdown and the gridlock in Congress. But will it last? That's a question Vietnam vet Dave Comer, someone with decades of experience with the VA, asks himself every day.
Because they hired more people and they did put on pressure. But when the pressure's reduced and when the dog and pony shows go away and the tents are folded and they're out of town, what happens? How do they perform at that point in time?
A good question, but for now, Edwin Del Rio is one of the lucky ones.
It definitely makes me feel more secure financially, and that if I need something that's supposed to be provided through the VA, that eventually they will provide it.
How many more lucky veterans like Edwin Del Rio will there be, and how many more will be waiting? Joining us now is Aaron Glantz, reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting, who documented the backlog at its worst earlier this year and has watched the improvement for months since. Aaron, welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you.
So this is some good news here, but it's guarded.
Well, the VA has done a lot since March when we exposed that the backlog of veterans waiting for benefits for conditions as severe as post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury had increased by 2,000% under President Obama. This 250,000 veterans waiting more than a year. The VA has brought that way down. We heard from some of the veterans who got their benefits. But, you know, as you heard Dave Comer say, when the pressure is gone, have we really come up with some systemic solutions to these problems?
I mean, part of the issue here is, you know, you would think that the number of veterans waiting would be pressure enough, but it doesn't really work that way because the veterans medical system and the Pentagon medical system are just two different, completely uncommunicative worlds, right?
Well, I mean, that's part of the problem. But I think the bigger problem is that nobody is paying attention most of the time. You know, when you have 250,000 veterans waiting more than a year for their benefits and nearly a million veterans waiting overall, which was the situation in March, you know, we don't have a draft. Most people don't feel that. It takes exposure in the media, clamoring by members of Congress, all of which we saw in the spring, to get a bureaucracy like the VA to really focus on doing its job. You know, we reported in March that the VA under Obama had spent $500 million on a new computer system, and yet 97% of the claims remained on paper, and that in some offices, like the Winston-Salem, North Carolina office, there was so much paper that the VA's inspector general found that that was compromising the structural integrity of the building. That all had to be exposed for politicians to get involved, for the media overall to get involved, and then for the VA to really focus, because in the absence of that pressure, you know, the bureaucracy just looks like any other bureaucracy. It doesn't necessarily do its job.
So the backlog has improved, but really the pressure needs to be maintained on the VA to keep the improvement going. Aaron Glantz, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Aaron Glantz covers veterans and domestic military issues for the Center for Investigative Reporting. You can find all the advice we've collected with our friends at the Center for Investigative Reporting at cironline.org/vetadvice. You know, thinking about veterans on this Veterans Day, is there a wisdom from experience in battle, a hardship, a sacrifice, a sense that something was lost, childhood, innocence? Do veterans understand something that civilians can't understand, or are the worlds completely separate? Is that what we are to understand? Veterans did a job. We in the media, or as voters, just talk about the job they did. Talk about it a lot. Was the war a good idea, a bad idea? Veterans, we're told, don't like to talk so much about their experiences of wartime. We continue our conversation with Jason Wazelski, former Army medic who served in Afghanistan in 2012. Also, David Retzky, former UAV pilot who served in Iraq from 2004 to 2005, both of whom have advice for fellow soldiers coming home, and both of whom told us they could have used more advice coming back into the civilian world themselves.
It's really important to get registered with the VA as soon as you get back. So if you do need care, you're in the system and you could take care of it. But the main thing I think would be is don't try to rush into civilian life. You know, take your time. If you don't feel comfortable going into a big crowd initially, then don't put yourself in that situation. If you need to, you know, go out with people that you're comfortable with at first and gradually work into being able to go out by yourself or go into big crowds, then take that time.
David Retzky, what was the hardest thing for you? How did you acclimatize yourself?
Hardest thing for me was just adjusting back into civilian life and learning how to take care of myself all of a sudden. I had to worry about paying my own bills, getting my own food, and finding my own job at this point in time.
And who helped you in that? Did you do it yourself?
Well, this time I was married, and I relied heavily on my wife and my friends. When I first got out, I got a job almost instantly and ended up leaving that job to move to follow my wife's job.
And was that tough?
That was incredibly tough because I went from being in a society of having basically all my friends around me in the military to moving in with a couple of my best friends to all of a sudden it just being me and my wife in a strange city.
And what advice would you have for somebody who's going through that experience or something like it?
My best advice is I found a lot of comfort in meeting a lot of civilian friends. Instead of seeking out military friends, finding civilian friends made it better for me because I could kind of get away from my experiences and help adjust and see how these people lived in their civilian life and at first almost mimic it. And then eventually figure out what made me a civilian now and no longer a soldier.
Jason Wazelski, what's the best advice you could give a civilian acquaintance of yours who might be curious about your experience?
I think that's going to be a situational thing, depending on the person. But something for your civilian peers is don't dig. And when I say that, I mean, if you notice that somebody's uncomfortable with the questions you're asking, don't continue along your thought process of asking those questions.
Has that ever happened to you before?
Yeah, it has. I think initially, right when I came home, I remember the first night I came home, I went out with some of my friends, and I mean, all I want to do is hang out with them and you know what I mean, catch up. And then you get some people that just start, you know, asking questions after questions after questions. And actually, one of my friends is the one that said something. He's like, hey, you know, this is our friend. He just got home. Like, let's hang out with him, catch up with him. You know what I mean? Stop nagging him about this stuff. He doesn't want to talk about this right now.
What's the worst mistake you made that you wouldn't want to repeat coming home from Iraq or Afghanistan, Jason, and then you, David?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it'd have to be not thinking you're invincible. You know, you make it home, you're alive, you're happy, but that doesn't mean you can't come back here and do something to hurt yourself or get yourself killed. And I think that's a big thing that people coming home need to know, too, is you're definitely still mortal. You know, don't hop on a motorcycle, go fast, and something like that. If you look in numerous news reports, you'll see there'll be a veteran that comes home within a couple weeks and, you know, makes a mistake and gets killed. And, I mean, that's terrible. You know what I mean? You got to avoid that, those situations.
David?
I completely agree with what Jason said here. And the closer you come back from your deployment to the time you separate from the military, you also have to realize now you have a whole ton of freedom and you can do things such as drinking whenever you feel like it. And you have to be able to tailor that in. A lot of emotions come out if you get drunk. For me, I got chatty and I think I over-talked about my experiences to civilians and I turned off a lot of potential friends and made people think I was more unstable than I actually was because I thought they would enjoy these stories or I was possibly just showing off and trying to look tough at the time.
Well, David and Jason, I really appreciate your candor and I want both of you to have a great Veterans Day.
Thank you very much, John.
Jason Wasileski is a former Army medic who served in Afghanistan in 2012. And David Retzke is a former Army UAV pilot who served in Iraq from 2004 to 2005. Some more advice. Don't have expectations about family and spouse relationships. Remember that being physically together again takes getting used to and may be different than you remember. Story from one of you in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. How about this? Take it slow. Don't try to take over at home. Enjoy your loved ones, but don't pressure them to be the people you left behind. They have grown and taken on new responsibilities. More importantly, get help if you are having trouble. That's from one of you from the Air Force in St. Cloud, Minnesota. From Charlotte, North Carolina, find resources in your community to help you adapt and reconnect. A big challenge is recreating the support network you had when you were deployed. There are lots of great people and organizations out there eager to help, but you need to help them find you. And from St. Margaret's, Maryland, find a mentor, a veteran that has successfully transitioned back to civilian life, and don't be reluctant to ask for help. Advice, we've had it all hour, and you can continue that conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. But some deeper dreams of veterans coming up in just a moment. A jazz musician weaves veterans' dreams into his music. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by PBS. Presenting a new presidential portrait from American experience, JFK. Premieres tonight at 9, 8 Central on PBS.
Veterans have more to say than how the Army is treating them or what it was like in battle or how it feels like to be home. The disconnection between the military and civilian cultures in America can be frustrating, so we're seeking advice from veterans this Veterans Day. From a vet in Deer Park, New York, while there is always room for improvement, I'm so glad that vets are treated so much better today. If I wear something that has a Vietnam reference, then people tell me thanks for my service. So to other vets, be proud. And here's a story from Providence, Rhode Island. It's been 3 years since I got out, and I'm just now feeling like a normal civilian human being. I advise vets, take it slow. Focus on that small picture first. Advice from vets to vets. You can find all the advice we've collected with our friends at the Center for Investigative Reporting at cironline.org/vetadvice, or give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, and be a part of the conversation. Finally, for this Veterans Day, it wasn't until we began to hear these voices from World War II that the stories inside these men of the so-called Greatest Generation were told.
No, first of all, there's no science in fighting a war. It's luck. There's no future. And the present is unpleasant. That's it.
Hawaii right now might be the island of paradise, but it was a hellhole of creation that day.
You know, you get to a point, you're just about like an animal, I guess, where you know a footfall, a cough, a sneeze. It's just a sense that you develop.
We're also listening to veterans. But for listening, we might have lost those stories of World War II. And there are stories and feelings and ideas also returning quietly from Iraq and Afghanistan.
When alone with my war toys in a muted room, I could hear my mother call my name. From the unknown recess just beyond my ear.
As a jazz musician, Vijay Iyer is very good at listening. He's an acclaimed jazz pianist and composer. He also found those voices of vets for a project called Holding It Down, the Veterans Dream Project. Vijay is trying to hear the America of now, and that's partly a musical sound and partly the soft, powerful voices of American veterans with much to tell.
That was a big part of it for us, to listen to what America sounds like right now, including the aspect of America that people don't really want to listen to. When I think about the veterans community, I'm kind of reminded of the birth of the blues, which I'm a big fan of Amir Baraka, you know, his book Blues People, where he sort of traces the emergence of a new kind of American post-emancipation. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. Like suddenly there was this newly freed, so-called freed African-American kind of person that was kind of left to reflect on his own predicament. And that sort of what the sound of the blues really was that sound of facing that new reality.
You can run, you can run. Tell my friend boy with a brown. You can run. Tell my friend boy with a brown.
And when I think about the veterans community today, I mean, there are 3 million or more of them. I just mean from the recent wars.
Right, from Iraq and Afghanistan.
You know, these are kids in their teens and 20s who face a similar kind of predicament in the sense of having lived through something really harrowing, and then they come back and are kind of facing indifference and even near invisibility. What we focused on with this project was, what do they dream about? What are they able to dream about? What do they carry inside of them that maybe they would prefer not to talk about otherwise?
Well, let's hear a couple of examples. Here's track 9. It's called Name, from your album Holding It Down.
One day I went from civilian to serviceman, became airman and sergeant, referred to only as female, a gender, no personality, no individuality. Everybody looked like me. Straight backs and creased pants and hair pulled back so tight in a bun, skirts. And everybody looked like me. Unmanned aircraft called drones, Predator, came with no formalities. Courtesies, no ranks, no last names. It was a club, the good old boy system. And what you did there was attached to your name, but your first name.
She's a veteran?
Yep, that's Lynn Hill. She was in the Air Force for 6 years. And for 2 of those years, she was a drone pilot, which means she sat at a console in Las Vegas and flew unmanned aircraft over Iraq and Afghanistan.
Do you know her? Did you get to know her?
Yeah, she's a good friend. She's a wonderful person. And, you know, she was haunted by all of this for years. And had nightmares and was in therapy and went through a pretty wild existence for several years. She talks on one track about having dreams of driving herself off a cliff. She also dreamed about the families on the other side, and she felt like those could have been her family. And she also told us about the day that she quit and why she quit. And she quit because she heard her colleagues cheering, and she said, that's not who we are, you know.
Is this an anti-war message, or is it something deeper than that?
It's pro-human, you know, and it's about compassion. But that also involves compassion for those who went through this on our behalf and whom we paid for to do that. You know, we paid for this to happen with our tax money, and in fact, we voted for it. And so it's about listening to what we collectively have wrought.
This doesn't play as like collage. I mean, did you go into this thinking that these voices would be like materials that you'd put on a canvas, kind of like a painter? Because you're describing these people as friends and colleagues and people who are unforgettable now in your life.
Yeah, we built this together. You know, that's what it is. It's a collaboration. We knew from the beginning that if we wanted to accurately and justly represent voices from the veterans community, it had to be through collaborating with them. It couldn't just be from collecting their stories like some dream-catching demon or something, you know. We had to really win their trust because it had to be not just about them, but it had to be created by them and with them and for them, you know, because we really don't know what it's like.
Well, that's what jazz players are good at, listening.
That's a very good point, and that's a point I try to make often, is that that's what we do more than anything else.
Vijay Iyer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Vijay Iyer is a jazz pianist and composer. His new album is called Holding It Down, The Veteran's Dream Project. He's also a recipient of this year's MacArthur Grant. Take a listen to some of Vijay's tracks at thetakeaway.org. Some advice on the way out from Chicago. Everyone's different. Take time to decompress and reconnect. Remember, you're still important. If possible, volunteer. Use your experience and drive to continue your mission in a different way. Make new glory days here, where you are also needed. Happy Veterans Day to all those who have served, and thanks for that service. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.